From Pacifica Radio, KPFT 90.1 Houston, this is Open Journal in Exile. Open Journal is the Houston community magazine of the airwaves. Join us as Duane Bradley and Stephanie Coleman explore the wonder that is the Petro Metro and the people who make it happen. And now from our temporary, socially distanced, alternative studios in exile, somewhere in the greater Houston area, this is Open Journal in Exile. Let the conversation begin.
You're tuned to Open Journal. This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT, FM 90.1, and digital channel HD1, Houston's community station. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for your support. I'm Duane Bradley.
And I am Stephanie Coleman. The Texas Tribune is the only member-supported, digital-first, nonpartisan media organization that informs Texans and engages with them about public policy, politics, government, and statewide issues. Erin Douglas is the environment reporter for the Texas Tribune. She was previously a business and economy reporter at the Houston Chronicle, where she covered labor, energy, and environment. Before moving to Texas, Erin worked as an intern at Bloomberg in New York and at the Denver Post, her hometown newspaper. We're glad to have you with us. Thank you for joining us, Erin Douglas.
Thanks so much for allowing me to be here.
Welcome to Open Journal, Erin. So what is it that you see as the most pressing environmental issue that we here in Texas are facing today?
Oh my gosh. Well, that is a big question. I think that the most encompassing environmental issue, not just for Texas, but for the nation, for the world, is climate change. And that truly, to me, touches every single environmental issue in Texas, whether that is coastal erosion, whether that is hurricanes, whether that is the energy transition to lower carbon economy, whether that's drought, heat waves, agriculture. It is the backdrop of everything in this state. Water, you know, you name it. Climate change is pretty much, I would say, the most pressing issue, not just for Texas, but for the nation. Mm-hmm. And more specifically in Texas and the nation of the whole is this issue of climate change and environmental health. And what I mean by that is environmental degradation, or how the climate is changing our world, is really causing public health crises. And we see that across the nation, but definitely here in Texas as well. So,
Well, knowing climate change and the impact it has on every other sub-issue, as with too many times, the national legislature, kicking the can down the road is the easiest thing in many cases. How is our state legislature handling this?
Yeah. That is an interesting question. And being that this is my first legislative session to cover, I only have a certain perspective. But I will say that before the winter storm in Texas that hit in February and the power crisis that resulted from that, there was not a lot of climate or environment bills in the legislature. There were a handful from Democrats. Texas Democrats have really been pushing for some sort of state climate plan to get in place. And that's been interesting to watch. But after the winter storm, I mean, that really changed the session. It was the biggest environmental crisis that the state has ever seen. Millions of people were out of power for days. Hundreds of people died. We had people without water. We had people without heat. These are environmental concerns. So while on the face of it, it's an electricity problem, it's really an environmental problem as well. So I think that, you know, after the storm, we have all of this legislation to require power generators, transmission lines, natural gas facilities to make upgrades to withstand extreme weather or to do a host of other things. They're not calling it climate legislation, but it really is climate mitigation legislation. And there's science to suggest that more extreme weather is a result of climate change. And these storms may happen with increasing frequency, or we may see more extreme weather patterns. And so, you know, if we're going to upgrade our electric grid, if we're going to make investments, we have to acknowledge how the climate is going to impact those investments, right? what I see in the legislature is not a lot of talk of like climate change is happening. We need to prepare. We need to include these upgrades or these plans. But what I do see is like on individual projects, you see climate legislation, a climate mitigation. So I don't know how the legislature will deal with this issue going forward, because, you know, there's the argument to be made that if you don't have climate planning, then is it enough to just respond to the events? And that is what I'm seeing in the legislature, is a lot of response to climate events.
You know, that's a very good question with that, in terms of being reactive and also being capitalist in the way we do business and the way we sell energy, buy energy, receive energy. Do you think there is a point in the way we live as Americans and as the way we see ourselves as community and part of the planet, that there is a physical behavior shift that's a part of that conversation, or those very separate conversations?
Part of the way that I approach my environmental coverage is that humans and the environment are not two different things, right? We all interact with one another, and we're all part of the same ecosystem in the same planet. So yeah, I think that there are some lifestyle structural ways that we've set up our economy that aren't compatible with protecting not just the environment, but ourselves in our own communities, in our own neighborhoods. And so it is interesting to watch in Texas as we sort of reckon with the energy transition, given that the oil and gas industry is such a huge component of our state's economy and a component of Houston's economy, right? And so I think that if you talk to folks in the oil and gas industry, they, for the most part, I've seen in the last couple of years at least, coming around to like, okay, climate change is real. We can't ignore this. We're going to be part of the solution. We're going to do natural gas, which is lower carbon burning. You know, there's all these different carbon capture. There's all these ideas in the oil and gas industry. And I don't necessarily think we can discount that. If you talk to experts in the energy world or in the environmental world, you sort of need a all of the above strategy to mitigate climate change. It's such a huge problem. So to the extent that the legislature is going to pass climate mitigation legislation, I mean, that's ultimately helping us move towards a cleaner world. And so is it enough? I don't know. I'm not the right person to ask that question, but it's for somebody else to debate, but it's something.
It's something. It's a step in the right direction. Your generation has done, I think, an amazing job of really being active in having these conversations and putting pressure on government and pressure on corporations to change behavior. Do you think that's a major influence in this change, or is it really just, it's kind of good timing or a synergy of all of these moments, like a perfect storm?
Yeah, I would agree with you that youth, millennials, and younger have really pushed this issue. But I would also just say that we're seeing climate change happen to a degree that maybe wasn't so apparent in the past. And also, I think there's just more education, there's more awareness. The press is certainly more aware of it, I think, now than a couple decades ago, maybe. And there's lots of more environmental reporter jobs out in the world, which is great for people like me. But yeah, I mean, I think that this is becoming an issue that is not sidelined to science pages anymore. Like there's more awareness that climate changes and environmental issues generally is something that affects public health. It's something that affects our economy. It's something that affects our politics. And it's not just this separate issue over here. It's like affecting all of our lives. And I think that part of that too is a lot due to the environmental justice movement, which sort of said, okay, no, like, we're not just protecting the polar bears. We're like trying to protect people's lives and protect people from pollution and protect people from getting cancer. You know, these sorts of really major issues, that is, you know, environmentalism and climate change is not something far away and removed from you. It's in your backyard and it is affecting your health.
You're tuned to Open Journal on Pacifica Radio, 90.1 FM in Houston. We are visiting with Aaron Douglas, environmental reporter for Texas Tribune. We thank you for joining us and for your support. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I am Stephanie Coleman. I know you're still sort of getting your feet wet in Texas, but are there government officials who are completely opposed to alternative energy? Do you see politics playing a major role in this?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, when the winter storm happened in February, one of the most interesting political narratives that emerged extremely quickly was we're going to blame this all on wind-powered energy and solar. Mm-hmm. And that was just a bizarre narrative to take hold in Texas in particular, because wind has been such a successful part of the electricity grid and makeup in Texas. And I think we are the largest producer of wind power in the U.S. in Texas. And so it's not like a small little industry that they're trying to go on the attack here. It was pretty odd for me to watch, knowing sort of the makeup and the energy industry. But I think that the narrative just got turned really quick by the oil and gas industry. And, you know, you saw Governor Abbott at the beginning of the crisis sort of pump the brakes on this narrative and say, hey, you know, all forms of energy are struggling to produce power during this storm. That includes natural gas and other what we call thermal sources of energy, which is like nuclear and coal. And then, you know, 2 days later, I think he's on Fox News saying that wind is to blame for the crisis. And so it is a weird time to report in Texas energy, I think, because they're going through this transition and you want the benefits of the emerging industry, the emerging technology. We want to attract, if you listen to people in Houston Energy Talk, they want to attract the next generation of energy producers, and they want to build carbon capture. They want to be basically the frontier of the energy transition and the low carbon economy, right? But then we sort of have this pull and push with the oil and gas industry where, for whatever reason, they feel that this is threatening and they go on the attack against wind. And so it is, I think, difficult for policymakers because these are two really important industries that are intermingled. And you have the oil and gas industry, which is so powerful and has been such a big part of Texas's economy for so long. But you also have sort of the future and the transition that we're all pretty much acknowledging we're going through. So I understand why it's difficult for politicians, especially on the right at the moment. But it's definitely an interesting time to watch energy politics play out. And they don't always make sense.
That's true. So, you know, beyond the existential threat that wind power may politically be played as for the oil and gas industry and how that's working out in the current session of the state legislature, the ERCOT, the Energy Reliability Council of Texas analysis, just came out recently and shared that wind power was actually a smaller contributor to the crisis than initially estimated. Has this, in your observation, changed any minds of folks working on legislation in Austin?
I don't know if it's going to change people's minds. I think it may change the public image of it. I mean, the ERCOT analysis, even early on in the storm and in the first analysis that they produced, it was never the case that wind was the primary culprit of the February power crisis. And so this is just, to me, farther evidence that we are so reliant on natural gas in our electricity grid. And part of the reason is because we've retired a bunch of coal plants as they've gotten too expensive. Wind and solar, mostly wind, has become really cheap in Texas. So we build a bunch of that. And, you know, in Texas, we have a deregulated market in the power sector. And so, you know, if you're going to build something and then you can produce power to the market that is cheaper than what this coal plant can produce, then that's the power that ERCOT takes up and buys. And so, you know, we've lost a lot of coal. We built a bunch of wind, and this dynamic has made us extremely reliant on natural gas. And natural gas in Texas is cheap because we have a lot of it because we're producing a bunch of oil in West Texas, and natural gas is a byproduct. So natural gas prices are low. Wind prices are low. Wind doesn't blow all the time, as Republicans will be the first to tell you. So we need a lot of natural gas in order to make the grid function. And so when natural gas goes down and we don't yet have the technology in our energy transition to have wind stored the power or like producing at its capacity, then we're beholden in Texas to natural gas on the electric grid. Mm-hmm. And so that is the primary cause of the February power crisis was natural gas plants not being able to function for whatever reason. So, yeah, I mean, I think the analysis is important that just came out, that it really puts into better context what happened with the storm. But, you know, it was never the case that wind was a significant contributor because we're so reliant on natural gas.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts for this upcoming summer power shortage long term? Are we on a path to debating the obvious or solving the apparent challenge in front of us?
Yeah, I just wrote about this recently because ERCOT had actually just produced one of the most extreme forecasts that they have ever produced for the summer. And so they do a resource assessment every season. Mm-hmm. And for this upcoming summer, in their preliminary assessment, they essentially found that they did some initial additional analysis in light of the February power crisis and said, okay, I guess these extreme situations can happen, not just one extreme situation happening as they had normally looked at it, but multiple extreme situations can happen at the same time. We can have an extreme weather event and we can have a shortage of this, or we can have high demand, and all these things can happen at the same time. And that really puts our grid in a lot of jeopardy. So they looked at this, and I mean, in all of their extreme scenarios, we would have a shortage of power this summer. If we have some extreme drought, if we have some extreme uses of power, you know, there would have to be like co-occurring crises. But as we learned in February, that is not impossible.
Right.
And
right.
Having it happen once is unacceptable, I mm-hmm. think. People died. So yeah. We need to figure this out.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of bittersweet that we are getting so many new people. There's such an influx of people across the country that are looking at Texas as a wonderful place to be for many reasons. How does that also play into that? Just the number of people pulling on our resources at the rate of increase. Can we ever keep up with that? Can you get ahead of that?
Right. I think that we can certainly keep up with it if we invest in the infrastructure to do that. And you have to acknowledge that climate change is happening and that you have to plan for it. So the influx of people in Houston, for example, is great, but you need to make sure that they're not moving into floodplains or right. building so that those people aren't at risk, you know? So I think it's just a matter of doing sustainable growth. Mm-hmm. That's a real word.
Coined by you right now.
So I think it's definitely possible. I mean, it's just a matter of acknowledging what's happening and then investing the dollars mm-hmm. in something very boring, which is infrastructure, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we just saw President Biden's new infrastructure plans. And, you know, I mean, maybe that's the way to get people on board for mitigating climate change or planning for climate change, because I mean, a lot of this is very boring. Like, we need to update the pipes. We need to build on higher ground. We need to, you know, do these things that are just reorganizing our cities and our lives and investing the money. And, you know, even in the electricity grid, right? That's another infrastructure project.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, at a base level, infrastructure is also like, I want these potholes fixed down the street.
Right.
You know, I want to be able to drive without having to get a new shock absorber every couple of months.
Yeah. And this is what we expect from our government, right? I mean,
right.
This is why we're paying taxes for the most part, I think, personally, yeah. is I want the, you know, the public things that I use to be functional and to work.
Well, there is that sort of idealistic thought that, you know, someone working as a politician is actually a public servant. I read that somewhere in civics class back.
It's a hot take there.
Still had them. So Aaron Douglas, I wanted to just talk a little bit about the Texas Tribune. A lot of reporters from Texas and throughout the U.S. have joined the Tribune. What's synergizing there? What drew you?
Yeah, I mean, I loved the Houston Chronicle. I really, really did. I think that what drew me to the Tribune was the opportunity to report the more statewide focus, policy focus. It was the beat that I wanted on environment. And so the culture and the values, I think, aligned with me. I mean, it's a public service mission driven shop. And that really appealed to me. I mean, as far as like the nonprofit world in journalism, if you're going to go into nonprofit news as a newspaper reporter, which is how I identify, I think that the Tribune is one of the best places in the nation to be. I mean, we've been around since, I think, 2009, and that's a long time. It's proven, it's well-funded, it has a pretty big staff at this point. And so I think that was attractive to me because I had worked in large newsrooms and I didn't want to lose that sort of support of colleagues and editors that you get in a larger shop. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just an attractive place to work. And then there's the excitement of reporting on the legislature and politics, which is something that I wasn't doing at the Chronicle. I was on the business desk, and so I was a lot more narrow there. And so it was just a good opportunity for me to sort of expand and tell some larger policy and people-driven stories.
Mm-hmm. So what would you hope readers get from your editorials that you would hope in your information that you would hope to engage those who follow you? What would that be?
Well, I think that in all of my journalism, I try to maintain that sense of public service and mission that the Tribune embodies. And, you know, informing people about really complex policy is really what I enjoy about being a journalist, is because, you know, none of us are experts. I'm not a scientist, but I write about climate and the environment and energy. And I try to take these complex issues and explain it in a way that is accessible to everyone and gets everyone involved. And so that is one of the things I find very exciting about the Tribune, is that we give our journalism away for free and anyone can use it. So, you know, even other state publications can use it and often run our stories across the state and local newspapers, which is, I think, amazing. So we're actually supplementing and building on the work of local journalism across the state, which is really cool, I think. And to me, embodies the values that I take in my journalism and my colleagues' journalism, which is that information, nonpartisan, accurate, fair information should be accessible to everyone, and everyone should be able to participate in our politics and our policy conversations. And so I think that that is definitely a hallmark of our journalism at the Tribune.
So Erin, as a member-supported media organization, much like we are here at KPFT, Pacifica Radio, 52nd year existing on the donations of the listeners. You can listen for free. Nobody made you put a dime or a quarter into the top of the radio to tune in to Open Journal today or to any of the 100 other great programs that come out of 90.1 FM in Houston on a given week. Similarly, I'm supposing with the member-supported nature of Texas Tribune, you're relying on a certain percentage of those who are tapping into that media source to say, wow, this is valuable. Somebody's got to support it in order for it to thrive and grow and be of service to more people.
Yeah, that's correct. And one of the things that I also was impressed by at the Tribune is that we don't only rely on one of these streams of revenues. So we rely on members and sort of small donors who we very much appreciate. And then we also rely on events that we're putting on. We rely on larger donors like foundations. I'm sure that you all have heard of TribFest in Austin, and that's a big fundraiser for us. And I think that this idea of, you know, using what we already do as journalists, which is, you know, bringing people together for interesting conversations, and then doing that in a separate forum that we can monetize, is really smart. It makes sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think public radio has, you know, really pioneered this sort of model in terms of getting members on board, doing events, you know, doing all these different ways of raising funds, and also at the same time engaging your community and your listeners, your readers. And so I think it's really inspiring. And I hope that there are more Texas Tribunes cropping up across the U.S. I'm from Colorado, and so I'm anxiously watching the Colorado Sun to see how they will do. But it seems like it's doing well, and I'm encouraged by it, especially as a young journalist. Watching years of layoffs is not that inspiring, just so to see new organizations coming up to produce nonprofit, nonpartisan, important journalism, local journalism is really cool.
So is texastribune.org the best place to access everything I need, including that member portal?
Yes, texastribune.org, Texas spelled out. Pretty simple.
Well, Aaron Douglas, we want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Open Journal here on KPFT.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. It is time to wrap this edition of Open Journal. We thank you for tuning in and supporting us. KPFT.org is the access point where you can do that anytime. The donate button is ready, willing, and able to help you through that transformation. And it's quick, easy, and painless. Open Journal in the memo of your check, so to speak, would be appreciated. And we do thank you for that support. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. Programs are available, including this program, at archive.kpft.org. And please subscribe to our podcast, KPFT O'Day. We are a dedicated all-volunteer production staff, including Rambling Rick Campbell, Susan Phillips, and Maverick. Open Journal theme music provided by Kevin McLeod. And join us on Open Journal next time for more great conversations. Thanks always for your support, and thanks for listening.
And as always, we like to leave you with a thought of the week. This comes to us from B.B. King, who said, "I'm trying to get people to see that we are our brother's keeper. Red, white, black, brown, or yellow, rich or poor, we all have the blues. Take care of each other."